Mary, talking about daily life practice feeds right into what I want to talk about tonight, which is a teaching about encounters with strangers. I'm going to start with a story. So this story comes from the Buddhist discourses, the Pali Canon, and in it, this wanderer, Pukkusati, who I'm just going to call Pukku for short, is wandering through rural ancient India and comes upon a village, and it's close to nightfall, and he asks for and receives shelter from a kind merchant, a potter, in the kind of shed workshop area. And as he's settling in for the night, like heaping up some straw and making kind of a, you know, a spot for himself, another stranger, wanderer, shows up at the door of this little workshop shed thing and says that the potter has said it's okay for him to be there as well, as long as it's okay with Pukku. Pukku says, great, fine, welcome. Come settle yourself in. There's plenty of room for both of us. And so, as it happens, both of them are robed monastics, and they spend most of the night meditating in their kind of separate corners of the space. And early in the morning, the wee hours of the morning, the stranger, who is impressed and inspired by Pukku's behavior, his kindness, his practice, strikes up a conversation. And the stranger starts by saying, who's your teacher? Who taught you what you're doing? And what kind of philosophy or dharma was a general word for ideas, truths in that era? What kind of dharma do you speak and live by? And Pukku then kind of lights up and describes how inspired he is by the Buddha's teachings and by the Buddha as exemplar and by his reputation. And talks about how the Buddha's teachings and the practice of the Buddha have changed his life. And the stranger seems to get really interested and questions him closely then. He's like, okay, so where is this teacher? And how would you know him if you saw him? And Pukku then says, well, I actually never met him. I wouldn't know him if I saw him. And kind of talks about, like, what I know the effect of his teachings, the effect of his practice on me. And at that point, the stranger is moved by Pukku's dedication and by the sincerity of the practice. Because you see, the stranger happens to be the Buddha sitting across from Pukku. And rather than revealing who he was, he just gives this teaching that slowly reveals who he is through the depth of the teaching. And it's a detailed, advanced teaching in understanding how subjective experience kind of arises through the senses and the most basic elements of reality, and how absent craving, how incredibly freeing that can be. It's a deeply worthwhile teaching. It's not what I'm going to teach tonight. I'm going to save it for another time. For our purposes, it's enough to say that the Buddha's teaching had two effects on Pukku. The first is he becomes highly awakened in a very short period of time. And the second is somewhere during the teaching, he recognizes who is teaching him and is delighted and more than a little bit chagrined at the end. There's a rather sweet exchange between the two of them. Turns out, you never know how the way you show up with a stranger might affect them or you, right? So tonight I'm going to talk about this. It's a different kind of advanced teaching. And rather than the detailed analysis that the Buddha gave Pukkusati, that advanced teaching is how we relate to strangers, others, even the estranged parts of our own hearts and minds, and how that can reveal the maturity or lack thereof of a practice and deepen the practice. Not incidentally, it can also promote much greater interpersonal wisdom and heart. So the invitation is to listen with both ears tonight. And by that, I don't mean just both physical ears, but to attune one ear to any interpersonal ideas, wisdom, practice lessons these stories spark. And the other ear can be tuned to considering your relationship with experience itself through this lens. It can be seen in both ways, interpersonal and intrapersonal, within the mind and heart and self. As that famous first two stanzas from the Dhammapada says, all experience is led by mind, created by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupt mind, and suffering follows the way the cart follows the hoof of the ox. And yet, still, all experience is led by mind, created by mind, made by mind. Speak and act with a skillful heart and mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow, internal and external. So, this story about the Buddha and Bhikkhu kind of points to the way that he engaged people across the social spectrum of ancient India, across different clans and classes, but later hardened into caste, closest thing that ancient India has to our concept these days of race, another harmful fiction. So, Bhikkhu actually means something like lowly or worthless, as a Pali sort of phoneme, if you will. It's associated with refuse collectors, with an ill-regarded clan back in that day. And Bhikkhu Sati, Sati, the word for mindfulness, seems to be some kind of wordplay, or perhaps less benignly, an indicator of that person's social class when he was ordained. He was ordained by another monk, not the Buddha himself, of course. So, he and the Buddha, nonetheless, these homeless wanderers dependent upon the kindness of this potter, met, and the Buddha didn't care. The Buddha offered him teachings, was impressed by his internal qualities, by his behavior, by his kindness. And it was that kindness and generosity that Bhikkhu Sati originally offered that allowed himself to awaken and the Buddha's inspiration. Seeing one of his second generation students, if you will, performing so beautifully the teachings. So in small, meaningful ways, wise attention to encounters with strangers can wake us up, or them up. Not dramatic like this necessarily, but little ways, right? Little ways. Here's another example of the Buddha's range of interactions with strangers. This is a story of a woman who came to be known as Pattachara. And some of you will know well who she is. I see some nods. But when the Buddha met her, she was a woman literally driven mad with grief by incomprehensible loss. She literally lost her children, her husband, her entire family, all in the space of a day or two. Everything. Home, everything. And the grief caused her to snap, and she became this unkempt, almost mostly naked wanderer, wailing and sort of speaking nonsense. And people would drive her away with clods of dirt and like not let her anywhere near them, except the Buddha. He encountered her, or perhaps more rightly, she encountered him. They somehow crossed paths. And instead of rejecting her or pushing her away, he looked her dead in the eye and he said, "Sister, come to your senses." Direct, clear honesty. Meeting her as a fellow human being. And then he taught. And you can imagine, I can well imagine, how deeply teachings on ending suffering would penetrate for somebody in that much pain. Right? So she ended up becoming, she ordained, and she ended up becoming one of the most highly respected nuns and early teachers in the Buddha's Sangha. It all started with him meeting her as a person. He met her with clarity, directness, honesty, and above all, compassion. We hope that you, that each of us can have a similar kind of directness, honesty, clarity, compassion with whatever parts of us are wailing or unkempt or dealing with grief, right? But what about strangers who aren't so kind or harmless? So there's stories about that too. And the first one is of a non-human animal, a large war-trained elephant named Nalagiri, huge and angry, trained to be hostile. And he was made drunk by the Buddha's jealous cousin. This cousin, Devadatta, was constantly trying to promote schisms in the Sangha. Like, he was jealous of the Buddha's power, position, status, and wanted it for himself and thought he could get it by dividing everybody. Well, so he got this elephant drunk, waited until the Buddha was in sight and loosed him from his ties, basically aiming this killer animal at the Buddha. And as the story goes, legend really, it was the power of the Buddha's metta, love, non-hatred, kindness, that literally stopped the animal in its tracks. It walked and then knelt, meeting anger, rage, with kindness. Now, I'm not suggesting foolhardiness on any of our parts with meeting an enraged, I don't know, bull, bear, whatever, though there are stories of people gentling wild animals and enraged people, for that matter, this way. It's more considering, what about the aggressive, confused, angry impulses in here, in the heart? Or more minor versions, like I'll talk about in a moment. We can hold those. They tame, they gentle, with a certain kind of love and non-entanglement and clarity. A much more minor, maybe relatable version for many of us is a story of the Buddha being approached by a man who's, I think it had to be a nickname or a sort of given name by his culture, Dandapani, literally means stick in hand or violent hand in Pali. And it's said that he got this name because he was very ostentatious and arrogant. And even though he was young and fit, he carried around this walking cane, very elaborate walking cane. And he would use it to make his points in very puffed up ways, right? And kind of like, arrogant guy. So in one story, well, actually, I'm going to say one more thing about Dandapani. He was the Buddha's jealous cousin's ally. They used to try to split up the Sangha together. So you get an idea of the kind of character we're talking about here. You know, not super developed personally or spiritually. So in one particular teaching, Dandapani comes, I imagine him stomping up to the Buddha with his stick. The Buddha is sitting quietly under a tree, meditating, one presumes. And Dandapani starts aggressively questioning him. What do you teach? What do you teach? Give me an idea of your philosophy. He wants an argument. He wants a debate. It's very clear. And the Buddha just sort of looks up at him and meets him with this, from the words one imagines, absolute calm and equanimity. And he says simply something about the teachings I proclaim have no argument with anyone alive in the world. No argument. And then he goes on to say something about not imputing ourselves and our craving into all the perceptions and notions we have about reality. I am distilling this. It's much longer in the discourses. Well, Dandapani is confused. And right in the story, it says he made a couple of funny faces, presumably vexed faces, and then walks away. Meeting hostility with equanimity and wisdom. I can think of a lot of worse responses than a hostile person getting confused and walking away, can't you? So what does it mean to meet provocation with wisdom and equanimity? What does it mean in our own irritated or fractious moments of our own hearts and minds? What does it mean outside of us to meet it that way? This leads me to the most famous story about the Buddha and a hostile stranger. I'm going to start with the backstory, which many of you have heard the front story, so to speak. But it starts with the story of this young man, very talented, brilliant young man named Ahimsa. Literally, non-harming is his name. Okay? And Ahimsa is recognized in his village and by his family as being just exceptionally kind, smart, loving towards others, just easy to get along with, gregarious. And so his parents scrape up enough money to send him to a very highly regarded spiritual teacher of a school some ways away, like many, many days walk, maybe weeks walk away in India. Okay. Ahimsa will like realize his potential with this teacher, right? Well, he gets there and it doesn't take long for him to become quite popular with some of the other students, and not long before he becomes the teacher's absolute favorite. Teacher mentors him, really like goes out of his way for him, and this creates jealousy in a number of the senior students who had been there before he had. And at first they tried to take their complaints to the teacher, but the teacher would not listen. So they concocted a plan, and separately, three different groups or more of them went up to the teacher at different times, spreading false rumors, negative rumors about Ahimsa. And at first, the teacher just refuses to believe it. But when the fourth group of people, separate people, come up to him and tell him, Ahimsa's trying to take your place. He's trying to get rid of you and take over now. Look at how popular he is. Then all of those layers of deceit finally turn the teacher against his student. Well, he calls Ahimsa to him, and he must have been in a horrible mind state, because rather than confronting him directly, he concocts a way to send him away, and he thinks maybe get him killed or something, which is to tell him, you have one final thing you must do for me in order to get the inmost teachings. And Ahimsa's like, yes, anything, master, because he really, really loves this man, right? Trusts him. And the teacher says, you must go kill 1,000 people and bring me a garland made of their fingers. And Ahimsa protests and says, no, I can't do anything like that. He goes, no, you must. You must trust me. You must do this. And so reluctantly, Ahimsa goes away and starts. And he becomes known as the great mass murderer, Angulimala. Anguli meaning finger, mala meaning garland. At some point in his horrible so-called spiritual quest of killing, he probably goes a bit mad himself. He's definitely deluded, right? But late in that process, more than midway through. It just so happens that the Buddha and his Sangha are traveling through the part of India in which Angulimala is operating. And the king in the area is explaining, no, no, you can't go through this forest. That's where this mass murderer is. You just can't go there. But the Buddha does anyway. Alone. And walking through the forest, it said he was motivated by compassion, not just for the victims to be, which were definitely a source of compassion, but towards this murderer himself. And walking through the woods, Angulimala starts to take chase after him, but somehow, through some sort of mythical, because this is a legend, power, he can't catch the Buddha, even though the Buddha is walking, you know, slowly, and Angulimala is running. So eventually he becomes frustrated and he yells, "Stop, monk, stop!" And the Buddha turns around and looks him in the eye and says, "I have stopped, Angulimala. It's time for you to stop." Direct, fierce, calm, compassion. And as this story goes, if it had turned out the other way, we never would have heard it, of course. Angulimala, his delusion drops away and he drops down. And in the moment asks the Buddha to ordain with him because he recognizes that he has met a true spiritual teacher. And he is ordained under his original name, Ahimsa. In telling Angulimala it's time to stop, that calm, fierce, compassionate no, the Buddha is modeling something else for us, not necessarily with mass murderers, but with the people who might benefit from a calm, courageous, fierce no in our lives, in our society, in our social media networks, wherever. It's also yet another way of meeting our own, any possible tendencies of delusion-based harm, self-harm, within our own hearts. Sometimes it's a compassionate, fierce, courageous no. So, for us mere mortals, how might we practice with and learn from encounters with strangers? These stories are the stuff of legend, or at least the stuff of awakened beings, right? And we have our own opportunities in our own very human, simple ways. On a relational level, how can it strengthen or test your practice to address what seems provocative or arrogant in yourself? And always the self first. And then, with that same kind of calm, compassion, non-delusion, perhaps in others too. Is it possible to meet unleashed delusion-based harm in our societies, families, selves? These are all examples, the simple ones we might do and the more dramatic ones the Buddha did, of what are called non-complementary responses. That is, meeting an emotion such as anger or fear with something entirely different, something that doesn't ratchet it up and take it into more and more of a feedback loop, but instead with something unexpected that cuts the cycle. It's very powerful. The power of a non-complementary response is distilled in another very famous Buddhist teaching that all of you have heard. That Dhammapada verse, that hatred never ends by hatred, by love alone, by non-hate alone, does it end. This is the ancient and natural law. So, to say more about this internal level, you can bring the lens, we can bring the lens of noticing the quality of your own heart and mind. We don't have to be perfect to engage. And we can learn from our actions, right? A teaching that you've probably heard many times before, I know I've said it many times before, is the Buddha teaching his 7-year-old son, Rahula, that before, during, and after an action, speech, or even an intentional, like, tear of thought, to reflect on which of these mental, physical, speech actions are harmful and which are beneficial. To stop the first and encourage the second. But an even simpler teaching, certainly for me and for a number of other people, is to invoke the intention of whatever quality you're hoping to cultivate, that you want to see in the world, that you want to feel in your heart. Let's say kindness or wisdom or equanimity. And begin to just gently notice whenever it comes up, without making a huge project out of it, everything that isn't that. And even more importantly, all the moments it does show up, to celebrate those moments. This is an invitation to notice the quality of the heart and mind without judgment, but holding with discernment, holding it lightly, right? And it's kind of a kindfulness practice. It's to bring a lens of how the heart is to experience. You can notice how greed and hatred and delusion and all their relatives show up in sharp relief when kindness is the goal or compassion is the aspiration, right? But the most important part is especially noticing and nourishing whatever conditions contribute to the wholesome qualities, the non-greed, the non-hate, the non-delusion, the kindness. Relating to others with this intention, whatever it is, benevolence, kindness, friendliness, even simple friendliness. This is a heart and mind training that can make relating to others more joyful. It can manifest mentally, verbally, through simple actions. Recently, I was at the grocery store and another person and I got to the line at the exact same moment. And it made such an impression on me that with a huge smile and kind of a laugh, he just gestured for me to go first. He was clearly delighted about it. And it made for a really good conversation, too, after that. You know, in the discourses, this kind of friendliness, cooperation, is described as viewing each other with kindly eyes. Right? Simple acts of kindness, humor, joy, connection, in daily life, have another benefit. They bring up a lot of joy. And they also can help, they help me notice equanimity or the lack of equanimity if my bid for friendliness, for connection, isn't something someone wants to receive in that moment. Okay, is that okay too? Can I be friendly with that? Right? These interactions with strangers are a really powerful place to cultivate this. Kindness, equanimity, other wholesome heart qualities. And to notice the quality of the practice. It doesn't have to be heavy lifting. It's just in the moment as it happens, right? All these little detailed moments make relating to others a source of more joy. And all these little detailed moments, they form the fabric of our lives, right? So we can bring more joy, integrity, courage, wisdom to these lives by practicing consciously how I'm showing up, how you're showing up with other people, especially with the strangers around us and within us. And we can do this in all kinds of ways, right? Large and small. Because, as I said before, how we relate to strangers, others, even the cutout and estranged parts of ourselves, it can reveal the maturity of practice and it can deepen the practice. It can also promote greater interpersonal satisfaction, joy, and harmony. So thanks for your kind attention. We have a little while for questions, comments, any responses, or just anything that you've noticed in your own life you want to bring to bear on this topic. Yes, Corey, please.
It was very nice. Thank you. And I was curious what inspired you for this talk.
It's a practice I've been doing, to be honest with you. And I find it so fruitful and so simple in some ways. Like, you can get as detailed with it as you want, but all of us, well, most of us, interact with people we don't know in our lives or don't know well. And to invite that in seems like a really powerful way to deepen and broaden the practice. And in full disclosure, I'm also very concerned about the state of our society. And it's coming from that place too. So it's both.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I kind of wondered. I find that if I reflect on how I meet strangers sometimes, and, you know, and just how a look, somebody's look or a slogan or a, you know, something about that, that there's a fear and a contraction that can happen. And I might meet them with armoring rather than openness and generosity. So that's a nice practice. Thank you.
Thank you for that reflection too. And what you're saying is so powerful, right? Because that armoring, that contraction, that's completely natural. It's like deeply ingrained in us as mammals, as primates, for a difference. But what does it cause in the other person? It causes the complementary response, the contraction. And so these things transmit, right? And they can build over time. And so can their opposites, the moment of joy, of openness, of friendliness, right? Yes, please, Linda.
So kind of the other side of this coin, my husband and I were just on a 10-day road trip. And we found ourselves each evening noticing the number of times that we were the receivers of people's kindness. And it was just lovely to see, you know, when we were lost or we didn't have the right reservation or whatever we had done. And people were just so willing to be kind and helpful and to have that mindset of looking for those things in our day, as opposed to all the things that didn't go right or not great interactions, perhaps with somebody, really made for a lovely way to end our evening.
What a beautiful reflection and beautiful practice. Yeah. There are good people everywhere, right?
There are.
Yeah. Kind people everywhere. Thank you. Yes. Pam. No, Patty. Sorry. I can't read. Type is too small.
So I read an article a few months ago that has really influenced me in this area. And it was about paramedics and firemen and how when they respond to a call, they never care what the political leanings are of the person they're helping. And it dawned on me that I am very critical and very judgmental when I see someone's t-shirt or bumper sticker or slogan. And it never dawned on me that if my goal is to help people, those things should not have any influence at all in my radiating kindness over the entire world. And so I've tried to train myself using bumper stickers and t-shirts as a trigger. And every time I see one that otherwise would rile me up, I say, think like a fireman. Think like an EMT. And I try to soften my heart in that moment and emulate the people whose lives are helping people regardless of where they're coming from politically or otherwise. So that really had a big influence on me.
That's fantastic, Patty. Thank you so much for the story, your story and the reference to the article. So you're using like the sort of bumper stickers or t-shirt messages or whatever as your trigger, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. A short corollary to that is my day job is that I am a hospital chaplain. And it has been the most powerful teaching for me in learning to connect with people at this such an essential level, very similar level of sort of life, death, regardless of the more, one might say, superficial level of their views and opinions, or mine, for that matter. So, Isabel, please. Hi.
Yeah, hey. That was a beautiful talk. Thank you so much. I moved up to Carmichael about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, and I didn't really plan on staying up here. But a few things are starting to change my mind. It is definitely a lot more conservative here, and I didn't think I'd fit in. But one of the things I've noticed lately is that strangers always ask me, so how's your day going so far? How's your day going so far? I hear it from everyone on the grocery line or at the park or anywhere. It's just like everyone is so friendly and really wants to hear about how my day is going. So I've started asking people that too. And it's just such a really nice community type of feeling. Makes me feel really connected. At first I thought it was just, you know, people just being polite, but people really expect you to answer. And so I do, often, you know, quite verbosely. But I'm really interested in people. So it's great to get that feeling, you know, that like, I really want to hear how people are doing, because I get the feeling they really want to hear how I'm doing. So anyway, just that's all I wanted to say. Just that the community up here is really sweet, and it's really starting to have an effect on me. So thank you for your talk.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the story too. This simple kindness, the caring about other people and what a difference that can make in connection, right? Beautiful. Any other thoughts? Yes, Deborah, please. You're muted.
I'm muted. Okay. Thank you. I also want to say thank you. And it's so interesting because I was out earlier and was having this kind of a conversation with a friend of mine. And we were talking about the practice of pausing, taking a breath, and somehow being, my brain's not letting me think of the word, in the face of other people's upsetness or anger, and what that triggers in us. She does not study Dharma, but she has another spiritual path, and I've known her for several years now. Anyway, we were just talking about this, about how to meet somebody who is upset, who is angry, who is violent. And it was in the context also of what's going on in the world today. We were both at a movie last night called The Third Harmony. I highly recommend it. It's about nonviolence. And you can look it up online, nonharmony.org. And it's about nonviolence, the work that's going on around the world. I wish it were in every possible school in our country and every library. And we've both been there happenstancedly, and then we met up today. So we were having this conversation. And in my own life, I find it so much easier to make friends with the person online at the cashier at the grocery store, or I've made friends with cashiers places I've gone to for decades. It's so much easier for me personally to, whatever the person's age or size or color or whatever religious garb they may or may not have on, or it's so much easier for me to be friendly and sort of feel on equal footing than when I'm triggered by somebody I know better. It's interesting. To thank you for just talking about this again, the movie last night, and then talking with my friend today, and then noticing within myself. My mother used to say to me, "You're just like your father, you make friends wherever you go." And it's true, I'm fairly friendly and outgoing. But when there's hostile or negative triggers of some kind with someone who isn't a passing stranger, it's harder. It's just harder. And that's where the practice comes in. I have to have compassion and ease with myself before I can lend it out outward.
Absolutely. That's a great observation and insight. And as is, like, there's a reason I started us with strangers tonight. That's easier. That is not the heavy lifting, friends, as you well know. You know, the relatives who are on the opposite side of the political spectrum, or the friend with whatever obnoxious social views or whatever it is, right? Those get much, much harder. And show us wherever attached.
So, thank you, thank you, thank you. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. I really appreciate what you have to say, especially about the ease and compassion and generosity with ourselves first. It ain't going anywhere unless we can have a little bit of it here.
That was hard to learn too. I'm still working on that.
Yeah. That's because you're human.
Thankfully.
Great. Thank you. I think we might have time for one or two more. If anyone else wants to chime in. Somebody. Oh, hi, Rick. Yes.
Well, thank you for the Buddhist stories. I always really appreciate the traveling Buddhist stories. I learned so much. When meeting strangers, you never know what their story is, what their history is, what their past, what they've done, who they are, and what happened to them that day, today. Well, what experience did they have today? And you'd be surprised, you know, if you did get a chance to find out. Appearances are very deceiving about people, and especially older people. the older people have sometimes very interesting stories that you wouldn't even begin to understand or know, and that it goes both ways. They don't know your story. They don't know your history. They don't know what happened to you today or yesterday. And so it goes both ways, that you don't want to make any assumptions when you're meeting with strangers, and judgments. Be open to be surprised, both positively and negatively. And they have the same thing with you. They don't know you. And so, anyway, I really appreciate the Traveling Buddha Stories. And thank you very much. Very well told.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate what you're saying about not judging a person, especially elders, by how someone looks or presents, right? We just never know. And being open to being surprised positively or negatively, either one is new information and new learning that can lead to greater wisdom if it's held with that in mind. So thank you very much for the insight.